let you manage that. I would, well, let's wait till some of these papers get handed out back there. By way of introduction and background of this presentation, I'd like to make a few points before I start. The paper that you have in front of you is actually a revision of a paper I did about a year ago for a course in pseudepigrapha, and that has some importance for what we're doing tonight, because that paper was initially intended as a literary analysis of a given theme, and we'll find out it's the appearance of heaven, solely in the pseudepigraphic literature and the development of that. So that thrust is still in this paper. However, at the time I wrote it, the relationship to New Testament was merely in a footnote, because that was not the thrust of the paper. I've decided to revise it tonight to include that, because I think that would be of most interest to what we're doing. Therefore, there are basically two objectives to what we're doing. First of all, is to become familiar with the pseudepigraphic literature a little bit more than some of us might be already. And secondly, to see how some of these themes and topics and the development of them relate to what we find, the allusions we find to heaven in the New Testament literature. So there's two objectives. Now, I'll be very frank with you, the latter, as far as I'm concerned, is in some respects still in my initial thought process stages. So after we're through, I'm very open to your thoughts on this, contribution of whatever you happen to want to do with it. The second thing is I'm going to read the paper. I hope that won't insult your intelligence. I know you can all read too, but it seems to be the most efficient way to handle our time. And secondly, it's something for you to follow along, note down your questions, and I think maybe we'll all profit a little bit more from this if we do it this way. To start out, you'll notice I have a rather long introductory section, and the reason for that really is to explain the title. You'll notice the title is The Appearance of Heaven in Pseudepigraphic Apocalyptic Visions, and it's going to take us some time to really understand what I'm doing with this. So let's begin. Depending on the orientation of each individual reader or listener, the word heaven may bring to mind one of several possible impressions. For some, the term may simply indicate that which is not earth. In other words, the sky or the rest of the universe. And I would add that translators of the NIV, for example, when they're saying, and God made the firmament in the Shamayim, heavens, simply translated, and he set the firmament in the sky. Except I think they translated expanse in the sky. So there's a sense in which we would just translate this possibly sky. To others, it has the additional significance of the sphere of ultimate total goodness, where the divine person of God dwells, and where the souls of saints rest. Both of these are essentially intangible, and to a great extent invisible and unknown. Their difference, at least from the perspective of the literature, that is, the body of literature we're going to deal with, resides mainly in whether the subject is considered in a physical or a theological, philosophical context. On the other hand, the elements of the former, which are visible and somewhat known, may be involved as one tries to conceptualize the latter. The definition, with its points of distinction and points of similarity, is important to note at the outset, because this is one of the problems I have encountered as I have surveyed the literature for references to the appearance of the spiritual realm of heaven. The term appearance implies the physical dimension, or at least the possibility of conceiving of something in that dimension. The spiritual realm, on the other hand, transcends that. When, however, a subject defies observation and description, the inevitable speculations which arise tend to schematize it in a way which gives it structure and physical characteristics. The task is then to decide which texts, using the term heaven, refer to only the physical astronomical phenomena, or only the supernatural sphere of deity, without being descriptive, and discard both types. Those which remain are presumably those which refer to the spiritual realm, but conceptualize it in terms of some sort of physical structure, or with certain observable characteristics. A further complication is the very fine distinction which I see between the general use of brief figurative expressions, and we've all read in Scripture the gates of heaven, the windows of heaven, depending on the translation, and the presence of a more complete description of heaven based on a concept or multiple concepts which may have been common theological knowledge to the contemporary audience. These latter frequently appear in visionary passages where some chosen individual is transported to, or at least allowed to see into heaven. The choice to deal mainly with visionary material in the pseudepigrapha alleviates to a certain extent the problem of whether or not we are confronting a simple figurative expression or something more. These visions, of course, are founded upon biblical texts, most of which are themselves visions, but some of which are simply brief figures. In dealing with the biblical information, the major criterion governing my use of the material concerns the length and complexity of the passage. If it is merely a phrase mentioning portals or windows or gates or something like that, I've not used it. When, however, these features and others are part of what seem to be a structurally related series of features, then it falls into the category in which I am interested. Presumably, the popular concept of heaven did not arise in a vacuum. On the contrary, it was based on every shred of information which could be gained from the sacred literature, the Bible, and sprinkled with notions which appear to have been prevalent in surrounding cultures. Now, I'm not going to turn to footnote one at this point, but I have a very lengthy, well, not very lengthy, but somewhat lengthy excursus on sources, secondary literature, which refers to both Mesopotamian and Greek conceptions of heaven. And the interesting feature is, in the Mesopotamian things, both earth and hell are very often depicted as having seven layers. And the Greeks had a tendency to compartmentalize heaven too, although they didn't say seven or something like that. So this is not something which is strictly located in the pseudepigraphic literature. We see it in these other cultures as well. You can turn to that when you have time to read it. Furthermore, the various references to heaven of this type which occur in the literature should be expected to exhibit a certain amount of similarity, since most of them are products of the religious segments, either Jewish or Christian, of society living in Palestine in the first centuries B.C. and A.D. So now we define the first part of our title, we go on to the second. There's some difference of opinion as to how to classify certain works of antiquity. This difficulty points to the additional problem of defining the categories more carefully so as to know which works may be considered apocalyptic and which might, in addition, be classed as pseudepigrapha. An apocalypse is a revelation of secret, hidden facts. As a genre of literature, it is that type of material which purports to reveal information about God and about his divine purposes. The contents of apocalyptic writings have certain characteristics in common. For example, there is a strong emphasis on God's plan and determination of universal history, as is worked out in successive stages. And I would call to your attention, if you're not aware of it already, that Revelation in our New Testament is an apocalypse. We see that. Daniel in the Old Testament is an apocalypse. So this is not a kind of literature which is outside the canonical literature. We also have examples of it within. The knowledge of this, in other words, this plan and determination of universal history, and wisdom in general, comes through special revelation, often in the form of visions. Further, there is a strong belief, reflecting the apocalyptic writings, in immortality, judgment, and the resurrection. Each of these features is important in terms of the apocalypse regarding heaven, which we're going to look at. An additional factor often, although not always, characterizes apocalyptic literature. Works of this nature are frequently synonymous in authorship, in other words, attributed to some known and honored person in antiquity. In fact, this practice was so common that the term pseudepigrapha has come to mean a specific body of literature in which this occurs. It is not, of course, completely synonymous with apocalyptic literature, but there are many features which are common to both. In his attempt to define more carefully the boundaries of the category, Charlesworth outlined the following criteria. First, it must be partially or totally Jewish or Jewish-Christian. Second, the work should date from approximately 200 B.C. to 200 A.D. as far as its total compilation. And if you think in New Testament terms, you can see how significant the correspondence and date would be. Third, it would claim to be inspired. Fourth, a piece of literature of this type is attributed to a prominent Old Testament figure. And fifth, it is related in form and content to the Old Testament. Now, my primary source material for visions of heaven comes from within this corpus. Seven of the works commonly known as pseudepigrapha contain at least one vision of heaven. These are 1st Enoch, the Testament of Levi, 2nd Enoch, 3rd Baruch, the Apocalypse of Moses, which is also known as the Life of Adam and Eve, the Apocalypse of Abraham, and the Ascension of Isaiah. For the sake of understanding the contents of these visions more fully, however, I shall begin with the appropriate references from the Old Testament. The key elements in the biblical texts which are pertinent to the topic are of two kinds. The first includes all the aspects which are present in the visionary impressions of heaven recorded in the Old Testament. The second involves all the references which possibly hint at plurality and or levels of heaven. There's only a minimal degree of overlap between these two categories. In the first case, the majority of passages briefly express the terrible and awesome appearance of heaven or of some representation of God in heaven. In Exodus 24, we have the narrative about the reading and confirmation of the covenant. Following that, Moses, Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, and the 70 elders ascended the mountain. Verse 10 reads as follows. They saw the God of Israel, and under his feet was a structure of sapphire pavement, and it was as heaven itself, for clearness, purity. The word there is the word which is customarily used for ritual purity or cleanness, and that's what has been chosen to represent this vision, or at least an aspect of this vision. 2 Kings 22:19-23, and the parallel passage in 2 Chronicles report the vision of Micaiah the prophet, which he narrated to Ahab and Jehoshaphat when they called him in for consultation, and he prophesied contrary to the court prophets. Quote, I saw the Lord sitting on his throne, and all the host of heaven standing over him to his right and to his left. The continuation of the narrative indicates the presence of evil spirits in heaven, since at least one of them stood before the Lord and declared how he would deceive Ahab. We might conclude from this that there is room somewhere in our concept of heaven for the presence of evil beings. This is supported by the references in Job chapter 1, verse 6 and 2:1 to Satan's presence before the Lord. Although this is not a visual feature, it occasionally shows up in later literature within a given vision, so it's important in that sense. The vision in Isaiah chapter 6, verses 1 through 4, pictures God upon a throne as well. In this case, it is located within the temple, presumably in heaven, of which the earthly temple was a replica. The first chapter of Ezekiel is unquestionably the most explicit of the biblical descriptions. We are told in 1:1 that heaven was opened, or the heavens were opened. You can take that either way, the word is Shemayim. And Ezekiel saw visions of God. After the vision of the four living creatures and the wheels beside them, there is further information about what was above the creatures, starting from verse 22. Over the heads of the creatures was what looked like a firmament, which was as the sparkling of fearsome ice. It was spread above their heads. And by the way, the word firmament is rakia, and it's difficult to get a good translation. Oftentimes you see expanse as the translation. I've chosen to stick with firmament, although I'm not totally pleased with it, because expanse implies nothingness, you know, just a sort of an empty void there. And however we choose to interpret that, the people that are reading this stuff and are going to be writing what we're going to read eventually saw it as something. And so at least when I'm using the term firmament, I want to understand that they're seeing a level, or at least a divider. So we'll stick with firmament. In verse 25, we are told that a voice sounded from above the firmament. Verses 26 through 28 read as follows. Above the firmament, which was above their heads, was a likeness of a throne which had the appearance of sapphire. Above on this likeness of the throne was what appeared to be the likeness of a man. And I saw the sparkle of something shining. Excuse me, I'm going to stop right there. This translation is trying to convey something rather interesting. The word is chashmal, which in modern Hebrew is the word for electricity. And it's very intriguing that this is the way they're going to translate it, the sparkle of something shining. But if you can imagine what electricity must look like when it sparks, it's brilliant. It's just absolutely brilliant. And I think that's, if there's any correspondence between biblical Hebrew and modern Hebrew, and I firmly believe there is, that might give us some idea if you think of electricity for this, at least the appearance of electricity. Okay, I saw the sparkle of something shining, which had the appearance of fire surrounding it, from what appeared to be his waist up. From what seemed to be his waist and down, I saw the appearance of fire and brightness surrounding him. And the appearance of the surrounding brilliance was as the appearance of the rainbow, which appears in a cloud on a rainy day. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. I've been very literal in translating this for a reason, even though you're probably tired of the terms appearance and likeness. You'll see. In addition to the fire and the brilliance which are emphasized in this passage, the most striking feature is the great care which is taken to keep the reader from thinking that this description is the exact representation. The terms appearance and likeness are used in abundance, as if to indicate that the real thing cannot be adequately described within the limitations of these forms. The elements of fire and brilliance are evident in one final passage as well. In Daniel chapter 7, the prophet recorded visions. One of them, verses 9 and 10, is descriptive of the throne of God. Quote, I was looking until thrones were set up, and the Ancient of Days sat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head as clean wool. His throne was flames and fire. Its wheels were burning with fire. A river of fire gushed forth from before him. Thousands served him, and myriads stood over him. He sat in judgment, and the books were opened. Here again, the terrible and awesome element is fire. To emphasize the pure and shining aspect, the whiteness of snow and wool is part of the description. We might recall the sparkling of ice amidst the brilliance of fire in Ezekiel chapter 1. And then we're moving to the second aspect that I said earlier is involved in the biblical description, and that is this idea of plurality or levels of heavens. In the area of structure, the biblical material again very carefully avoids the danger of excessive words to represent what might be involved. There are, however, a few bits of evidence which, when considered together, may indicate that at least a plurality of heavens, and possibly distinct levels, was part of the biblical picture. First, the term Shemayim itself conveys, morphologically, the idea of plurality, and I would just say the ending, the im ending, is a plural ending. That's simply speaking. Second, Deuteronomy 10:14, 1 Kings 8:27, and the parallel in 2 Chronicles, Psalm 148:4, and Nehemiah 9:6 all use the same expression, Shemayim u'shmei ha-shemayim, the heaven and the heavens of the heavens, or whatever way you want to put that together with the singular and plural possibility. Grammatically speaking, this is a way of stating the superlative, simply the highest heaven. In addition, however, it may represent something about the nature of heaven, and it certainly affected the concept of heaven which developed among the religious circles in Palestine. Finally, the information in Genesis 1:8, 14, 15, and 17, and the expression which is used over and over again there is the Rokia HaShemayim, the firmament of the heavens, suggests that the firmament which God called heaven was only part of the whole. I'm not saying it means that necessarily, but it suggests the possibility. Related to this, the sequence in Ezekiel chapter 1, verses 25 and 26, makes it sound as if the firmament was only a layer of heaven. Although these are not the only references to heaven in the Old Testament, they are the ones which are applicable to this question. Clearly, the writers of the Old Testament stayed away from extensive expositions of the topic. This, however, is not the case in the non-canonical literature. Armed with all the biblical allusions, many of those authors attempt to portray the subject as explicitly and vividly as possible. In the interest of acquiring a sense of the literary development of the subject, among the various sources, I've chosen to present them in chronological order to the extent that that is possible. Although none can be dated exactly, there is in most cases sufficient evidence to at least obtain a rough date and arrange the sources relative to one another. As a means of introduction to each vision, I shall give a brief sketch indicating why that individual was an appropriate person to receive the revelation. Remember I said that the figures of pseudepigrapha were known and renowned figures in the Old Testament, and usually there's a reason why they have received the revelation. Following each set of data, I shall note specific elements in the narrative which reflect the biblical information in its contemporary books. In some cases, certain features appear to be there because of the circumstances of the visionary or the audience for whom the apocalypse is intended. And we move to First Enoch. This text is a large composite work, some parts of which are significantly earlier than others. The specific chapters with which I am concerned are chapters 14 and 71. I would interrupt for just a moment. There are many, many other references in 1 Enoch to heaven. But only these two talk specifically in terms of a visionary experience. There's a very interesting journey in chapters 17 through 25 of Enoch's journey through the whole cosmos. And he tours earth and hell, and at first what seems to be heaven, but it turns out not to be, as you read it carefully. So I've left that out on purpose. And then also in the parable section, around the chapter 60, 50 and 60 area, there's a lot of talk about paradise, but again, it's more from a theological perspective. It doesn't give us a vision. So I'm just explaining why I've left those things out, and we're only dealing with two distinct visions here. Nicholsberg assigns at least a 2nd century B.C. date for the first, that is chapter 14, while chapter 71, at the end of the parable section, seems to have been added in somewhat later time. Enoch was a biblical figure who attracted an extensive amount of this type of literature because of the Genesis passage, chapter 5, verses 22 to 24, which indicates that he lived a much shorter life than others of that time, that he walked with God and that God took him away. Kind of a mysterious passage when you read it. We don't know exactly what it means, and the writers had a good time with that. The assumption underlying the various works attributed to Enoch is that when God took him away, he revealed to him all sorts of esoteric information. Since Enoch was from the pre-flood era, one of the major things that God would presumably make known to him concerned the events which would bring on the great deluge. Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 through 4 are, in some cases, very hard to understand. Who are the sons of God? What does it mean when it says they came to the daughters of men? Well, this is one of the things that these writers, in thinking back to Enoch, attribute to him. He finds out why all this in Genesis chapter 6 took place. Okay. Therefore, the early portions of 1st Enoch deal with the fall of the Watchers. This is chapter 6 through 11. Watchers, by the way, is another term. It's the term which continually occurs for the fallen angels, and notably the leaders of the fallen angels. This is significant for our discussion, because when the righteous Enoch interceded for the Watchers, he was given a vision of heaven which he related to them to authenticate his message of their judgment. Now, I don't mean, again, to insult your intelligence, but this is kind of important. The fact that they would have been in heaven at one time and fell and were now somewhere else, if he could go to them and say, listen, I was in heaven. Here's the description of it. And then, of course, they would recognize what it was, and they would know that his words of judgment that God would say to him were indeed true. He wasn't making it up. That's why it's so important to the writer of 1st Enoch to say that he's been there, and this authenticates his message of judgment. Now, let's read through this. It's quite interesting. Behold, I saw the clouds, and they were calling me in a vision, and the fogs were calling me, and the course of the stars and the lightnings were rushing me and causing me to desire. And in the vision, the winds were causing me to fly and rushing me high up into heaven. And I kept coming into heaven until I approached a wall which was built of white marble and surrounded by tongues of fire. And it began to frighten me. And I came into the tongues of fire and drew near to a great house which was built of white marble, and the inner walls were like mosaics of white marble, the floor of crystal, the ceiling like the path of the stars and lightnings, between which stood fiery cherubim, and their heaven of water. And the flaming fire surrounded the walls, and its gates were burning with fire. And I entered into the house, which was hot like fire and cold like ice, and there was nothing inside it. So fear covered me, and trembling seized me. And as I shook and trembled, I fell upon my face and saw a vision. And behold, there was an opening before me, and a second house, which was greater than the former. And everything was built with tongues of fire. And in every respect it excelled the other in glory and great honor, to the extent that it is impossible for me to recount to you concerning its glory and greatness. As for its floor, it was of fire, and above it was lightning in the path of the stars. And as for the ceiling, it was flaming fire. And I observed and saw inside a lofty throne. Its appearance was like crystal, and its wheels like a shining sun. And I heard the voice of the cherubim, and from beneath the throne were issuing streams of flaming fire. Now, this description may initially be impressive as one grand blaze of fire and brilliance, and it is. It's a very wordy way of conveying that. Further consideration, however, reveals that the authors carefully incorporated most of the elements from the biblical passages which are pertinent. We see the brilliance, here visualized as crystal and fire, over and over again. The throne, the wheels, and the cherubim of Ezekiel chapter 1 are present. The streams of flaming fire remind the reader of Daniel chapter 7. The mosaic pavement on the wall sounds like Exodus 24. The awesome paradox of hot like fire and cold like ice seems to be based on a literal understanding of ice in Ezekiel chapter 1, referring not only to its sparkling whiteness, but also to its terrible chill. The fact that there are two houses in the vision, and the lofty throne which seems even apart from the second, may be a slight indication that heaven was viewed already at that time as segmented in some way. There is, however, no direct indication of layers at this point. In 1st Enoch chapter 71, and this is a much briefer passage than the former one, the same qualities of light and fire with the brilliance of crystal are apparent. Here, too, we have a further interesting feature. The distinction between heaven and the heaven of heavens is such that Enoch's spirit has to be translated again to arrive at the latter. I'll read it and then sort of recap this stuff. my spirit passed out of sight and ascended into the heavens. And I saw two rivers of fire, the light of which fire was shining like hyacinth. The archangel Michael also showed me all the secrets of the extreme ends of heaven and all the reservoirs of the stars and the luminaries. He carried off my spirit, and I, Enoch, was in the heaven of heavens. That carried off my spirit is the key point. That's where he's being translated again. There I saw, in the midst of that light, a structure built of crystals, and between those crystals, tongues of living fire. And my spirit saw a ring which encircled this structure of fire. On its four sides were rivers of living fire which encircled it. So here we get the same pictures we had in the first passage, chapter 14. It's shorter, but you still see fire and blazing brilliance all over the place, and possibly a hint at more than one level of heaven. But again, nothing really explicit. Nobody's saying these are all the levels of heaven here. It's just maybe part of it. We move on to the testament of Levi, and I think I'll take just a moment to describe testamentary literature. We use the term now, the last will and testament. And in a sense, they used to do that back then, too, with a certain kind of literature called testamentary literature. What they did was to write a pseudepigraphic, hypothetical testament and attribute it to a major figure. Some of the most known ones are all the sons of Isaac. Jacob. Okay. And you have the testaments of the 12 patriarchs. Each one of those men supposedly writes down his last will and testament. And there's a certain form that these all follow. They first call all the children and the grandchildren and whatever are all around them, and they're all gathered around the bed of the dying saint. And he recounts his life. And in doing so, he says, now here were my pitfalls, so you watch out for those. Okay, and it's a very moral kind of message woven into a form, at the end of which is a list of blessings and cursings, very often, not always. And sometimes these are accompanied by a report of a prophecy that this visionary figure, not visionary figure, testamentary figure would have, or in some cases a vision. So they follow this form. It's a last will and testament which this person leaving the earth gives to those who are following him. And it's supposed to have a real impact. Now, with that in mind, let's look at the testament of Levi. In general, the testamentary literature does not have overwhelming characteristics of apocalyptic visions. The reason, however, why Levi's differs in this respect was his prescribed function as the minister before the Lord's sanctuary on earth. In preparation for this office, he was brought up to heaven to stand before God in the sanctuary there. So, in other words, for him to be able to function as an intermediary in the temple, performing sacrifices and service, the idea was that he would have to be taken to heaven so he could observe that temple in heaven and see how all that functioned. That's why he gets a vision. Dating this work, which is one section of the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs, is complicated. A 2nd century BC date is suggested, but nobody's taking a firm stand on it. It, along with the other testaments, appears to be of Jewish origin. There are, however, extensive Christian editions. Furthermore, the Testament of Levi exists in its entirety in three different versions, Slavonic, Armenian, and Greek, and there are also Aramaic fragments, but these are the true complete ones. Now, this is a problem, as we shall see. These exhibit significant differences in the passage under discussion. The variations may represent changing views regarding the structure of the heavens. However, common to all three versions is a great sea hanging in heaven. This is certainly taking into consideration Genesis chapter 6. Chapter 1, verses 6 and 7, which describes the firmament, a part of heaven, separating the waters above and below. Two of the three versions of the Testament of Levi picture only three heavens. The other, perhaps influenced by later literature, expanded the structure to seven. I prefer to read as probably a little more authentic the one which has three, and that's one which is quoted as follows. Then sleep fell upon me, and I beheld a high mountain, and I was on it. And behold, the heavens were opened, and an angel of the Lord spoke to me, saying, Levi, Levi, enter. And I entered the first heaven, and saw there much water suspended, in other words, the great sea. And again I saw a second heaven, much brighter and more lustrous, for there was a measureless height in it. And I said to the angel, why are these things thus? And the angel said to me, don't be amazed concerning this, for you shall see yet another heaven, more lustrous and beyond compare. And when you have mounted there, you shall stand near the Lord. You shall be his priest, and you shall tell forth his mysteries to men. Listen, therefore, concerning the heavens which have been shown to you. The lowest is dark for this reason. It sees all the injustices of humankind and contains fire, snow, and ice, ready for the day determined by God's righteous judgment. In it are all the spirits of those dispatched to achieve the punishment of mankind. In the second are the armies arrayed for the day of judgment to work vengeance on the spirits of error and of Belial. Above them are the holy ones. On the uppermost heaven of all dwells the great glory and the holy of holies, superior to all holiness. There with him are the archangels who serve and offer propitiatory sacrifices to the Lord on behalf of all the sins of ignorance of the righteous ones. In the heaven below them are the messengers who carry the responses to the angels of the Lord's presence. There with him are thrones and authorities. Their praises to God are offered eternally. At this moment the angel opened for me the gates of heaven, and I saw the Holy Most High sitting on the throne. Now in the mention of judgment for sin and propitiatory offerings, we clearly have references to Levi's intended role in the sanctuary. In terms of the visual aspects of heaven, the scheme seems to be similar to the concept underlying Enoch's vision. Snow, fire, and ice are encountered in a lower heaven, while the dwelling of God is far above that. The idea of levels is somewhat more specific, and each one has particular features. The snow and ice ready for judgment may be allusions to Job 38:22. That's the thing where it talks actually about chambers of ice and chambers of snow, which will be ready for the day of battle, and it goes on. This is when the Lord is coming back with answers to Job and his searching. All right, that sort of gives us everything we have in the Testament of Levi. Let's move on to 2 Enoch. Because there are hints that the Second Temple was still standing, by the way, the destruction of the Second Temple was in 70 AD, still standing when 2 Enoch was composed, the first century AD is a possible time for its compilation. The dating, however, is very uncertain, and some scholars place it much later than the first century. It is clearly a Jewish work, but has sufficient parallels with traditions from Alexandria to suggest that it may be a product of the diaspora. It's important to realize that this is an altogether different work from 1st Enoch. However, the assumptions regarding Enoch's status as one who received revelation and some of the general contents are the same. Again, we find Enoch ascending to heaven. This time, however, the purpose is not to intercede for the watchers, but to be given specific information to pass along to his children. The details of his journey through the heavens are much more elaborate, and there's no question about the fact that it was divided into at least 7 distinct spheres. By the way, one of the versions goes beyond 7 to list the names of the 8th, 9th, and 10th heavens, but this clearly also seems to be a later addition, just from the way that it comes in the style form. Now, I haven't quoted all of these parts of 2 Enoch because it's very, very long, but I'm going to take the liberty to read at least through level 3 to you because I want you to get an idea of the floweriness. I mean, it just gets more and more and more as we go through these things chronologically. If you thought 1 Enoch was flowery, wait till you just listen to what goes on in 2 Enoch. I won't read it all, but you can see as things tick by on 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, I've summarized it in a very brief fashion compared to what's really going on in the text. This is page 110. Are you there? I know you're following that. I'm going to read from J, the J version. Okay. We'll start right at the top of that one. And it came about when I had spoken to my sons, those men called me. Those men turned out to be sort of angelic beings that conduct him through this whole thing. And they took me up on their wings, and they carried me to the first heaven, and they placed me on the clouds. And behold, they were moving, and there I perceived the air higher up, and higher still I saw the ether. And they placed me on the first heaven, and they showed me a vast ocean, much bigger than any earthly ocean. They led before my face the elders, the rulers of the stellar orders, and they showed me the 200 angels who govern the stars and the heavenly combinations. And they fly with their wings, and they do the rounds of all the planets. And there I also perceived the treasuries of the snow and the ice, and the angels who guard their terrible storehouses, and the treasury of the cloud from which they come out and go in. And they showed me the treasuries of the dew like olive oil, and the appearance of its image was like every kind of earthly flower, only more numerous. And the angels who guard their treasuries, how they are shut and opened. And those men picked me up and brought me to the second heaven. And they showed me, and I saw a darkness greater than any earthly darkness. And there I perceived prisoners under guard, hanging up, waiting for the measureless judgment. And those angels had the appearance of darkness itself, more than earthly darkness. And unceasingly they made weeping all the day long. And I said to the men who were with me, why are these ones being tormented unceasingly? Those men answered me, these are those who turned away from the Lord, who did not obey the Lord's commandments, but of their own will plotted together and turned away with their prince and with those who are under restraint in the fifth heaven. And I felt very sorry for them. And those angels bowed down to me and said to me, man of God, pray for us to the Lord. These are the fallen angels who are bowing down to him. And I answered them and I said, who am I, a mortal man, that I should pray for angels? Who knows where I'm going and what will confront me? Or who indeed will pray for me? And those men took me from there and they brought me up to the third heaven and set me down there. Then I looked downward and I saw paradise, and that place is inconceivably pleasant. I saw the trees in full flower, and their fruits were ripe and pleasant smelling, with every food in yield and giving off profusely a pleasant fragrance. And in the midst of them was the tree of life, at that place where the Lord takes a rest when he goes into paradise. And that tree is indescribable for pleasantness and fine fragrance, more beautiful than any other created thing that exists. And from every direction it has an appearance which is gold-looking and crimson, and with the form of fire. And it covers the whole of paradise, and it has something of every orchard tree and of every fruit. And its root is in paradise at the exit that leads to the earth. And paradise is in between the corruptible and the incorruptible. And two streams come forth, one a source of honey and milk, and a source which produces oil and wine. And it is divided into four parts, and they go around with a quiet movement. And they come out into the paradise of Eden, between the corruptible and the incorruptible. And it still is going on and on. I'm going to skip that because it's getting a little bit too flowery here. Enoch asks about this, and the men say, this place Enoch has been prepared for the righteous, who suffer every kind of calamity in their life, who afflict their souls, and who avert their eyes from injustice, and who carry out righteous judgment, who give bread to the hungry, who cover the naked with clothing, who lift up the fallen, etc. Now they're still in the third level, and look what happens next. Those men carried me to the northern region at the third level, and they showed me there a very frightful place, and all kinds of torture and torment are in that place, cruel darkness and lifeless gloom. There's no light there, and a black fire blazes up perpetually with a river of fire that comes out over the whole place, fire here, freezing ice there, and it dries up and it freezes, and very cruel places of detention and dark and merciless angels carrying instruments of atrocities, torturing without pity. And that's not the end. It goes on and into a very explicit description of some of the sins of the people who have arrived there. So you have a flavor in Second Enoch of the kind of really verbose, wonderful description that's going on. Let me very quickly look. The fourth level here, we have basically subsumed under this what's going on as far as astronomical phenomena, stars and so forth, and then lots of singing of angels. In the fifth level, we have the watchers, who are, again, the leaders of the fallen angels, and they're hanging there in silence. The sixth level, angels, angels, and more angels. And the seventh level, in very brilliant light, there are all sorts of incredible angelic beings, and they're praising the Lord, who is even yet beyond them. Going on the bottom of page 8, at the end of the seventh heaven, the archangel Gabriel placed Enoch in the very presence of the Lord. This last part of the journey, according to the longer version, brought him through heaven's 8, called Nizalot, or constellations, 9 Kochavim, which means stars, and then I'll quote what he sees on supposedly the 10th level, if indeed we read with this version. And on the 10th heaven, Aravot, I saw the view of the face of the Lord, like iron made burning hot in a fire and brought out. And it emits sparks and is incandescent. Thus even I saw the face of the Lord. But the face of the Lord is not to be talked about. It is so very marvelous and supremely awesome and supremely frightening. The most striking feature of Enoch's vision is the inclusion of places of punishment in the heavenly scheme of things. Two entire layers are designated prisons for the fallen angels and their leaders. That 2nd Enoch should also deal extensively with the subject of the Watchers is not surprising. Why, however, heaven is conceptualized as still containing them is puzzling. In 1st Enoch 17 through 25, as I indicated earlier, his cosmic journeys are described, and he does see these places of horror. But in that context, they are not connected with heaven as they are here. Furthermore, a region not too far removed from paradise is a fearsome place of punishment by torture. On the other hand, the very idyllic and alluring description of paradise itself is also new. Including the tree of life as part of paradise makes the connection between it and the Garden of Eden. I would be tempted to suggest that for some reason the ideas of human immortality and actual psychological and emotional rewards and punishments within the heavenly spheres were very important for the writer of 2nd Enoch. And I will tell you this, because I'm not going to read direct quotes from all the rest of them, there's no other visionary piece that has quite the flair of this one. It's unmatched, it really is. Let's move along to 3rd Baruch. As far as historical milieu, the horror for Judaism of the destruction of the Second Temple in 70 is reflected in the radical restructuring by the rabbinic circles, and that comes out in Mishnah particularly, and also in the Jewish pseudepigrapha, which followed the event. 3rd Baruch is an example of the latter and is dated to the 1st or 2nd century AD. Baruch is an obvious figure to represent anguish over the destruction, since, as Jeremiah's secretary, he would have observed the scene of the calamity in 587 BC, the first temple being destroyed. That is the setting chosen for this work. In the text of 3rd Baruch, questions are raised concerning the continued existence of evil and evil people, while the covenant people of God and their temple are destroyed. In other words, how can this happen? It's the Odyssey. The answer to these questions is presented to Baruch as a tour of heaven so that he can witness what might be termed greater reality. Again, because the descriptions are long, I'm summarizing. Let's quickly look at the levels. In the first heaven, beyond the firmament, Baruch entered the first heaven, traveled a long distance, and arrived at a plain where creatures, part human and part animal, were living. He was informed that these were individuals who, quote, built the Tower of Strife against God, and were thus banished, Tower of Babel. In the second level, Baruch again traveled a great distance, after which he found more creatures, quite like the first set, and these had given the advice to build the tower. In the third level, after an even longer journey, he saw a plain, a serpent, and Hades. Notice that Hades is on the third level. In addition, he was shown the vine, which led Adam astray, and the various astronomical phenomena which are there. In the fourth level, he saw yet another monotonous plain with a pool in the middle to which multitudes of birds flocked. When Baruch asked about the pool and the birds, the angels told him it was the place where the righteous came together. The birds are those who continually sang praises to the Lord. At the fifth level, it's a little bit of a surprise, the gate was closed and Baruch was informed that they needed to wait for Michael to open it, because from this point he received the merits of good persons and brought them before God. Angels who were in charge of the souls of evil persons also interceded at this point. Much emphasis is laid on this latter aspect. And then at this point, rather than going on to what might have been 6 or 7, Baruch was brought back to where he started from. Although the narrative is limited to the first 5 layers, instead of all 7, the generally gloomy nature is impressive. Only the fourth level does not have something unpleasant or ominous in it. And again, the tone as you read the actual text is really depressing. Even on the fourth level, however, the description is not overwhelmingly enthusiastic, considering that the righteous come together on a, quote, monotonous plane. The emphasis is clearly on the fate of those who have, in some manner, been displeasing to the Lord. Their punishment lies within his very domain. This fits in quite well with the circumstances which seem to have prompted the composition of the book, and leads me to suggest that whoever wrote it was fully aware of the 7-level heaven concept, but had no intention of using the entire thing in his work. Rather, he used it as a framework within which to construct his polemic against the evil nations of the world. Very possibly, he purposefully left out levels 6 and 7, because if they were more positive, they may have detracted from the tone of dire warning, And by the way, in a lot of Jewish literature coming from this, you see it particularly in the Midrash, at this point, there are a good number of things which are stories told against Edom, and Edom always represents Rome as an oppressor. So it wouldn't be surprising that a Jewish polemic would use this kind of a framework and construct something of that nature. All right, let's move along to the next section. Both the Apocalypse of Moses and the Life of Adam and Eve are two works in a whole cycle of books about Adam, whose contents overlap considerably. Because they contain very few historical allusions and are not a single composition, they too are difficult to date. This idea of anti-Christian polemics is a rather interesting dating thing in Jewish works, because up until the 3rd century, late 3rd century and 4th century, most Jewish work doesn't have a distinctly anti-Christian slant to it. It's after that that they really start going into very strong polemical things, one of the reasons being that in the early 4th century, Christianity became the religion of the empire, and Christian teachers in just the decades before that, and especially then, became very strong, and they were out proselytizing left and right, and the Jews had to respond to this somehow. And so we have reflected in Jewish literature from the late 3rd, early 4th century, a real rise in anti-Christian polemics. So that helps us, gives us some idea, possibly, of dating. If there's no anti-Christian polemics here, it has to at least be before that, and presumably it's even earlier. All right. The death of Adam and all the theological implications associated with the fall were topics of a good deal of speculation. A major question was whether or not God would ultimately have mercy upon the perpetrators of evil in the world. After Adam's death, Eve was given a vision of heaven to reassure her of Adam's fate. Quote, Eve said to Seth, "Look up and see with thine eyes the seven heavens opened, and see how the soul of your father lies upon its face, and all the holy angels are praying on his behalf." And subsequently, Adam was carried up to the presence of the Lord. After his audience there, God handed him over to Michael, and he said, "Lift him up into paradise, unto the third heaven, and leave him there until that fearful day of my reckoning, which I will make in the world." And the text further describes paradise as the preparations for Adam's burial take place, and it's described as a very lush, wonderful, beautiful, fragrant place. Although these are brief references, they show us two things. First, the division of heaven into seven parts was assumed. Second, as in 2nd Enoch, paradise, a fragrant and pleasant place of rest until the final judgment, was located on the third level. In the Apocalypse of Abraham, we have a text which comes from the same historical milieu as the preceding ones. In it, Abraham also weeps over the destruction of the temple. The choice of Abraham as a visionary figure is based upon the awesome incident in Genesis 15, when God made his covenant with him. Abraham fell into a deep sleep, and a thick and dreadful darkness came over him, verse 12. On the occasion of the sacrifice, and this is where the apocalyptic vision takes off from that verse, on the occasion of the sacrifice, Abraham was raised to heaven, and much of the history of humankind was revealed to him. The angel sent to take him to heaven identified himself as Yoel. And by the way, that's probably a combination of Yah from Yahweh and Elohim from, or El from Elohim. So it's the whole divine name put together. He identifies himself as Yoel, and I was called so by him who causes those with me on the seventh expanse, on the firmament, to shake. And then it goes on. Abraham was brought amidst the brilliance of fire and the uproar of singing into the terrible presence of the four creatures and the chariot. From what follows, we can deduce that this was the seventh heaven. An awesome voice commanded him to look down through the firmament, which he did. God further ordered him to look down upon the stars and number them, which sounds familiar to us from Genesis 15, and to gaze through the six heavens to earth and its creatures. Just as in the Apocalypse of Moses, here the existence of seven heavens is assumed, but it's not spoken of. Therefore, the author did not detail the contents of each level, whether they were positive or negative. Instead, Abraham transcended all of them in order to receive revelation in the very presence of God. Because this was the object, the description focuses on majesty. The piling up of superlatives in the recital of a hymn, which had to be sung over and over and over again in order to gain access to the presence, are reminiscent of the style of later Jewish mystical texts. That would be a whole paper in itself. Here, the concept of seven heavens seems to serve as a vehicle to help emphasize the transcendence of God. And then our last text, the Ascension of Isaiah. This, too, is a composite work, consists of three parts. The first describes the martyrdom of Isaiah. The second is the testament of Hezekiah. And the third deals with the vision which Isaiah saw when he was prophesying before Hezekiah. The second and third parts are clearly Christian writings because they contain references both to Jesus and to the church. The first, however, appears to be a product of Jewish tradition. All of them were most likely compiled by the 2nd century A.D. The person of Isaiah is also an apt one to receive apocalyptic visions, since he had the experience of seeing the Lord on his throne in chapter 6. In this pseudepigraphic text, Isaiah was escorted by a magnificent angel through the seven heavens. The host of fallen angels was hanging in the firmament, which was below the first heaven. Each successive heaven until the sixth was filled with a throne, radiance, and angels of increasing glory. All of the praise was directed to the Most High in the seventh sphere. In the third heaven, memory of this world faded, and Isaiah's person underwent a transformation as he ascended farther. This is similar to the thought in 2 Enoch that paradise was between corruptibility and incorruptibility. In the sixth level, Isaiah was informed that there was no longer a throne because all the glory was directed towards the next level. In the seventh, he encountered unspeakable brilliance, innumerable angels, and all the righteous souls from the time of Adam. And again, imagine this being said in very, very, very eloquent, flowery terms. After reaching the top, he further saw Christ descending through the seven regions to become man. He was told of the Lord's life on earth, and following that, he viewed his ascent back through the spheres, accompanied by resounding praise. With Isaiah 6's background, it's not difficult to understand the prominence of thrones and bands of singing angels. It is interesting, however, that little distinction is made among the levels of heaven. Apparently, as in the Apocalypse of Abraham, it was unnecessary. Rather, the point was to establish the inexpressible majesty and transcendence of God, and even more, to be a vehicle for an edifying message about Christ's descent from heaven to become human. Both because of the lack of variety and the increasingly effusive language, however, getting through all the seven levels is somewhat tedious. All right, let's do some concluding here. First of all, with regard to all the pseudepigraphic accounts that I have either read to you or summarized for you. It's fundamental to recognize the difference between the relative reticence of the biblical text, and by that I mean the Old Testament, and the verbosity of the majority of the apocalyptic visions. Even within the latter group, there are noticeable changes in style. First, Enoch and the Testament of Levi are quite compact and present mainly those features which have direct relationship to the biblical material. The others, with the exception of the Apocalypse of Moses and possibly 3rd Baruch, seem to be characterized by an overabundance of descriptive words and phrases. Among these, 2nd Enoch is definitely the most imaginative. Those which follow seem to be flatter and might even be called imitative. This is especially true of the final two, which seem to have characteristics of liturgical poetry. In addition to style, there are significant patterns in content as well. In the earlier material, there is a less rigid seven-level form. In fact, it isn't even there. The confusion between the versions of the Testament of Levi could testify to the somewhat later ongoing controversy as to how many distinct parts there were in heaven. It seems that, at some point, the concept of heaven became the accepted doctrine, if you will, and held sway for a period of time, at least until the system had crystallized into the list of names and functions of the Talmud. And that's it's no longer a visionary thing, it is just a list. Here's a name. Here's what it's for. Here's a name. Here's what it's for. I would suggest that the later rabbinic disputes over whether there were 2, 3, or 7 heavens, and these by later are 6th, 7th, and 8th century, are not necessarily indicative of controversy at the time those texts were compiled. Rather, they may reflect an awareness of differences from an earlier rabbinic period. Finally, as I have noted throughout, certain aspects of the content do change depending on the pseudepigraphic figure and the general historical environment during which the work was composed. Some features, such as the luminaries, moon, stars, sun, the firmament, the angel singing the praise, and the places for meteorological phenomena, seem somewhat more stable than others. They are, however, insufficient to occupy seven layers. The resulting vacuum is filled either with features pertinent to the particular narrative or with increasing magnitudes of sanctified being, as in the ascension of Isaiah, the angels just get bigger and brighter and better. And now here's our interesting part. Not that the other, by the way, was uninteresting, but this is where it gets most interesting. With these works in mind, it is instructive to see to what extent the New Testament reflects some of these same impressions. In Luke chapter 16, verses 19 through 26, paradise appears as Abraham's bosom in Jesus' parable about the rich man and Lazarus. Even given its literary genre, and I'm not making a negative statement about parallels here, I'm just saying about parables. I'm just saying maybe in parables we can't make everything be indicative of the way it really is. Right? So it's a parable, even though it's interesting to study the representation of heaven therein. Abraham's bosom is far up and across a chasm from the place of torment, and by the way, the word is Hades. All right? That should remind you of third Baruch. And yet there's some contact. This is similar to the relative locations of these places in second Enoch, as well as third Baruch. Further in third Baruch, oh yes, with its overall negative cast, Hades is on the third level. Luke also mentions paradise in chapter 23, verse 43, quoting Jesus' statement to the repentant thief on the cross, "Today you shall be with me in paradise." Again, the same idea appears in 2 Enoch and in the Apocalypse of Moses, where Adam was left in paradise to await the day of judgment. Most explicitly, in 2 Corinthians 12, verses 2 through 4, and I'm going to take the liberty of reading that because I think it might be interesting, so we hear it all. In fact, I'll start with verse 1 of chapter 12. Paul speaking, "I must go on boasting. Although there is nothing to be gained, I will go on to visions and revelations from the Lord. I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven. Whether it was in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. And I know that this man, whether in the body or apart from the body, I do not know, but God knows, was caught up to paradise. He heard inexpressible things, things that man is not permitted to tell." Let's go on. Most explicitly in that passage, Paul equates the third heaven with paradise. Further, although he does not specifically mention paradise in connection with the resurrection in 1 Corinthians 15, it is interesting that he notes a transition point between corruptibility and incorruptibility. And I'll save reading that passage for the time being. This was one of the aspects of the third level in 2 Enoch, transition point. The transformation which Isaiah experienced in the third heaven reflects the same idea. Paradise contains the tree of life in Revelation 2:7, according to John, and we saw this as well in 2 Enoch. Among the references in Ephesians to the heavenlies, which again is a translation problem, but we'll stick with that, where Christ is seated and where believers experience blessings, Paul indicates that there are also those rulers and authorities in the heavenlies who need the wisdom of God, implying that maybe they don't have it. In addition, and if that's a little fuzzy, this last one, in addition, these heavenly spheres contain evil elements, and it's presented to us as we need the armor of God against these kinds of evil elements, so they aren't weak little things by any means. Paul's statements are closer here to the impressions in the Old Testament than is the pseudepigrapha. In both Old and New Testaments, the evil spirits and Satan are represented as active in heaven. In the pseudepigraphic sections we've surveyed, they exist there, only exist there, enduring some form of punishment. Finally, John, in Revelation chapter 4, describes the majesty of the throne in heaven. What he saw in his vision is similar to that depicted in Ezekiel chapter 1. In addition, in front of the throne, there was a sea of glass, clear as crystal. His vision is quite different from the majority of the pseudepigraphic accounts, direct and brief, as are the Old Testament descriptions. Now, what are the implications of the correspondence that we find between some of these New Testament references, and particularly the ones about paradise I find particularly interesting, and the concepts reflected in various pieces of pseudepigrapha? Among the possible answers, there are several which do not detract from the view that the New Testament writers were inspired by the Holy Spirit. For example, we might suggest that there is indeed some sort of differentiation among the heavenly spheres. A fair case might be made for it, even on the basis of Old Testament information. Thus, when Paul was brought to the third level, paradise, He actually did ascend through several distinct heavenly spheres. It's notable that he did not wax long on intervening regions and contents. On the contrary, he could not speak of what he saw. It is the extra-biblical material, which, based on the same Old Testament texts and probably influenced by foreign ideas, specifies the number of levels and features of each. In the same way, Jesus' indication of the relationship between paradise and the place of torment would reflect part of the actual geography of heaven. In this view, there's not necessarily a dependence of Paul or Luke on their environment. In fact, it could well be that some of the later writers of pseudepigrapha were influenced by Paul, Luke, and other New Testament writers. And that, by the way, could also apply for my second suggestion, that last thing. A second possibility involves the use of figurative language. It may be that common to the religious parlance of the day were certain ways of expressing ideas about heaven. Paul, in conveying the truth of the revelation he received somewhere, wrote in terms which would be definitely recognizable to his audience. Likewise, Jesus' parable teaches certain truths about rewards and punishments after death and uses ideas and expressions familiar to his audience. To what extent, however, he intended to draw for us a picture of heaven, we cannot say. The primary focus is its general existence and the moral issue involved. I will just say about 30 seconds of conclusion after this. It's very easy to get wrapped up in a survey of the literary stuff and take it in an academic sense and that's all. But I think we have to recognize that to the writers of this stuff, whoever they were and whatever they thought about heaven, it was a really important subject, vastly important subject, and they treated it as such. And possibly we can take a lesson from that regardless of what their particular direction was when they were thinking. I will try to answer questions.
Well, this may be, this is subjective on my part. When I read it, I think they really believed it. It strikes me as very, very sincere. Sometimes, you know, when we're trying to say something we really believe, we really get totally effusive and sometimes tongue-tied. And that's the impression I get, at least with the earlier stuff. As I said, when you get later and... again, it's my perception of it. It seems to get a little more imitative and flatter. So maybe when you get into the later texts, they're just for a liturgical purpose or something, imitating earlier styles. But the earlier stuff seems to be really, should we say, genuine, I would say. If there are those of you who have read this stuff, maybe you can put your own two cents worth in, but that would be my impression. Blair? Yeah, that's the tough one. Maybe. Genuine in the sense that they are being, I really don't think they're trying to pull one over on their audience. Let me put it that way. And as you read some of the other stuff, and this isn't specifically visions of heaven, but some of the stuff in 4th Ezra about visions, they go through a process to get to this state. It's fasting, or it's just eating a few herbs here and there for a week or 2 weeks. And that kind of thing, even just totally humanly speaking, can bring on some sort of vision or visionary experience. So, you know, there's that element involved, too. I'm not about to say how much of what's involved.
No, no. On the one hand, you've got the book Mormon, and I'm not sure what you would feel the writer is sincere or not writing the book of Mormon. Not writing who he is, yeah. He wasn't. That sounds pretty sincere. On the other hand, I think that possibility that there were people involved in some kind of attempting to produce grant things. There's certainly not a reason for the information there. And what they would see, one, if they were just in some kind of purely subjective trance, which presumably would be their imagination and ability for them. Mm-hmm. What they would see if they were in something more than a purely subjective trance state would be another matter. It would bring up into the same sort of thing like near-death experiences and the drug-induced hallucinations. That sort of shit.
It certainly isn't beyond the realm of possibility. Yeah, right.
I don't know really what to make of that.
I guess what I'm saying when I say it's genuine, it strikes me as not being a literary product.
Not trying to set down probably. Yeah. Although even there, if the guys are sharp enough, I wouldn't take it. It's just very hard for me to draw any conclusion on what the author really thought.
Well, and the suggestion is also made, we're not dealing with author here, the communities who are dreaming up stuff. And I realize that's a whole another bag of worms when we get into community. But, yeah, on the other hand...
I read about 4 or 5 recensions to something that's more elaborate. Sure.
And you're talking about composite text, so bits and pieces coming from here and there. We really don't know.
It's interesting to speculate maybe about where you can stem from. The oldest one maybe goes back about the same time as the foundation of the Qumran. And the Qumran community has secret books. The Qumran community has fragments of Phoenix and people leave.
And the Testaments, too. They have fragments of that.
And their books were not to be revealed anymore outside the community. And there are several phenomena that if they were really split off from them to produce different dissensions, essentially. But what they were doing at Qumran to get these things.
Yeah, I don't dare say any more on it than that. Good question. Yeah.
They're all completely in moral purpose. In other words, when you fit into it, for the word teaching on
that seems to be the stated purpose in actually some of the things. That there was a purpose for the vision to authenticate this, well, and Enoch is a good example, to authenticate his rebuke of these sinful, fallen, apostate angels and anybody who happens to be associated with him. He has the vision of heaven. So, and as I said, with testamentary literature, there's a strong moral thrust in every one of the testaments, whether it involves a vision or not. Most of this literature is very intent on righteousness. Now, again, if you want to say that's genuine and sincere religion or something else, you know, that's a tough question. But it's very, very strong on goodness, righteousness, God's goodness, God's plan for the universe, very strong on all of them. Yes. Well, it seems, now this is where the interesting question of the parallels from other cultures ties in. Because it seems that in Mesopotamian stuff, they've actually found a crude map of, now granted it comes from quite a bit later, but a crude map that comes from that area, the Babylonia area, of 7 regions, which they've labeled specific areas of heaven. And this is reproduced in Millick's book, the Aramaic fragment from the Qumran K4, whatever it is. So the idea is that it's coming from Mesopotamian influence. Because you have distinct references to 7 levels of hell and 7 areas of earth. And 7 comes up quite often in these ways. Yes?
One suggestion might very well come, one from biblical terminology that keeps in the parallel along between the temple and heaven. Josephus comments at one point. Temple was some kind of representation of cosmos. And then the thing, I noticed a couple of these passages. One, the temple was presumably in heaven in some sense. The Holy of Holies might parallel the Heaven of Heavens or something of that sort. You can see some things of that sort in the Mother Office. When Solomon dedicates the temple, he uses the phrase of heaven, Heaven of Heavens.
Yeah, the temple was also seen often in some of this literature as a connecting spot. I mean, it wasn't only that you had a representation in heaven of it, but it's actually the connecting spot through which one made their entrance into heaven.
That's very reasonable.
Sure. Yeah. But they actually make this into a physical thing, you know, it's the place where you go up. Yeah. Did I answer your question? Okay. Yeah.
Forever.
Oh, and you're suggesting maybe the seven levels would disintegrate after the final day of judgment?
I don't know.
That would be nice. No, you don't see it in the passages. That's an interesting thought, though. That's not explicitly stated. I mean, I would argue from silence. It's not stated they're going to disappear. So it seems like they're there in perpetuity. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
You mentioned the real flowery and large descriptions of heaven. Do these writers also take time to describe the, like, the cherubim and the seraphim and things like that that they see in the vision and the angels who are being tormented?
Yeah, the second Enoch does quite a bit with the agony and the weeping and the anguish of the angels in torment, and particularly these the two, the ascension of Isaiah and the Abraham one, where there's so much emphasis on radiance. It goes quite a bit into the radiance of these great beings and how they just, well, they radiate all over the place, and it's said a number of times. Yeah, a lot is spent on appearance. Cherubim, chariots, thrones, brilliance, a lot of things with light and fire. It's quite descriptive. Doesn't appear to be. I don't remember any. Let's put it that way. Just offhand, I don't remember any. And even when Enoch goes to intercede for them and plead for them, nothing happens in that regard. They seem to be there for good.
I might mention one more point that the most powerful point here, and that is the word paradise is a word of art in Persian that means in a garden or something. And the Greek translation of the Testament is that the garden. So certainly by 200 or 100 B.C., at least the word paradise would call to mind during the Eden, and that explains at least some of the picture here where you've got the rivers and such that are obviously reflective of the Garden of Eden.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that that paradise is taken away from the earth, and it's going to come back.
It's very interesting that when you read First Enoch, and I haven't mapped this all out completely, but it sounds like he's actually describing two gardens of Eden once you read the whole thing and put it together. There is the real Garden of Eden, which is somewhere east of the world. Okay, if you go traveling, this is on Enoch's cosmic journey. If you go to the east, you find the real Garden of Eden somewhere. But lo and behold, if you go to the west, which he also does, you find the Garden of Eden, which is in heaven, which is the perfect prototype, I guess you'd call it. And it's a complicated thing. In response to your point, though, it seems like Enoch actually somehow or other conceptualizes two of them. One in heaven and one somewhere else in the cosmos. Different section. Different section. Yeah, the problem. Gray Lowe is the one who deals with that. Yeah.
I heard some different studies on somewhat different subjects. A couple of places I found some unusual connections in the material that suggested that they interpret certain biblical passages, which I never noticed, but to get a certain result. This idea of a region not too remarkable, far removed from paradise, with a fearful public punishment, there's a remark right at the end of Isaiah 66.
Mm-hmm.
Where people come out of Jerusalem and they see Enoch up there, apparently very close together. So there may be some Old Testament background in that story, particularly if they figure that the New Jerusalem is some kind of different Jerusalem with walls and adamant, etc., another Isaiah passage, and therefore, since it's not around anywhere you can see now, it must be up there somewhere. A number of these areas, on top of just perhaps either fantasizing or seeing some kind of vision, just the thorough familiarity with the human passage.
Is that thing you're referring to actually cite Isaiah in some form or other as support for their statement?
Yes, you are. Passage I'm thinking about is happy to go binding by the prisoners in the state. It represents some kind of yellow themes as well as some kind of humans being bound by prisoners in the state, etc.
Isaiah 24.
Yes, that's the passage. Mm-hmm. And wondering whether some of the construction regarding what happened to angels and such is not based upon trying to see whether that happened.
Well, your point about a thorough knowledge of Scripture is well taken, because all this literature just reflects, they're tying in biblical allusions all the time. Some of them are obvious, some of them aren't quite as obvious, but it's quite true, they did have that, and so that undoubtedly may have affected the vision, if you want to call it vision. Yeah, go ahead. There are voyages and journeys through the lower portions of the earth. Whether the intent is to search for lost ones, I can't tell you, because I honestly don't remember, and I'm not that familiar with the material that does that, but just offhand from the reading I've done, I don't know of any. I just know that they go through these areas. Enoch goes through the area. But it seems to be more of a tour to satisfy his knowledge, his need for knowledge, more than anything else, not a desire to find somebody or something. Yeah, what were you going to say? Yeah. I can't, you know, I can only speak for that one part that I know very well, the journey through Sheol and the underparts of the world. The other things I've cited from, the intent of so many of them is heaven, to describe heaven, and they don't even do anything at all with the lower portion. So I'm sorry to be ignorant on that. Dr. Newman, can you add anything?
To make the high priest someone who is personally descended in that family and to bring knowledge to the church and by this knowledge giving awareness of what it is in the community and the our time. And I was wondering if he had gotten.
Is that so much a descent? The reason I'm asking is because in Jewish mystical literature from a few centuries after this, you have a lot of leaders, religious leaders, priests, etc., who have to go through just horrible things to get their knowledge, but they're always going up. But they're encountering all these awful things, trying to get past the archons and the archangels and the this, that, and the other thing. And it's a struggle and it's a challenge, and they have to do formulas and so forth, but it's not going down to the lower regions, it's going to some realm of heaven. And by that time, by the way, there are hundreds and hundreds of heavens, not just seven.
You might be referring to the Greek idea of the other world and culture being different, but where did you find that?
I have not read the primary sources, but it's referred to in Hengel's book, Judaism and Hellenism. He talks about that, and that's, as I said, that's one area that I haven't pursued directly.
That would be quite different from the picture of the moment in the afternoon.
Okay, do you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, in Homer, you get the picture of the spirit, just like you get also in the Aeneid, of the spirit as being in sort of a dismal place, everything is dismal, and they're all more or less on the same level, and there's very little question. Between the best and the worst.
And that's supposed to be heaven, a parallel of what we would call heaven.
Homer is clear. Is it the right that wants to see?
That's where we find out about the two who have fallen and have been killed and haven't been buried, so we have to go back and bury them. But they could not be happy there anymore. And then you have in the Aeneid, you have probably David's picture. And what a close to the conclusion is that he's the Roman or that. But there doesn't seem to be any differentiation at all in those books.
I might be guessing, but I would think that Hengel, because he's talking about Hellenism, would be referring to a later time of Greek writings than Homer. But honestly, that's all I can tell you about it. Yeah.
I was going to say that what Virgil and a lot of the other Hesiod and Homer are talking about is the ancient, you know, pantheon of God. Now the Hellenistic religion, the Hellenistic religion is more an ethical, more a spiritual sort of religion where the gods are no longer thought of as existing as being real, and where people, where heaven became synonymous with attaining perfect goodness in your life, which is more significant than
I'll be perfectly honest with you, you're out of my ballpark by the time you start talking about Greek. You know, that is something I haven't dealt with. Thank you. Yeah.
The souls in the heavens, the righteous, the private souls, the holy souls, the righteous, are they there waiting for the resurrection?
They seem to be in paradise waiting for the resurrection.
Paradise waiting for the resurrection.
Yeah.
Did you ever mention where they will be after they are resurrected?
Doesn't seem to be. It's just assumed they're going to be probably taken up to the highest level.
Okay.
It depends on the text, whether this is explicit or not. But the ones where they say they're just in paradise, there's no promise of future this will happen.
But being in paradise is not the end of the stuff.
Doesn't seem to be. Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah, it seems that way.
How about the vision of the Messiah?
Well, are you speaking in terms of second coming, or, I mean, from a Christian perspective, they're seeing a second coming?
Jewish
perspective. This doesn't occur in the visions. You don't see it at all in the visions. There's not even, I think I can say this categorically, there isn't one reference to Messiah in the visions. The only time it occurs is if you have some Christian additions, and this one particular, which talks about Jesus coming down to earth, but that's undoubtedly a Christian one. Yeah, that's in the parables section, which doesn't, it's not visionary though. That's why I'm limiting what I'm saying to it. You don't have anything, any reference in the vision section.
No, it's not like in the vision.
Yeah.
But it's obviously a heaven or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We've been able to dovetail that last chapter of Isaiah 56, that last passage of the covenant, so it's really right.
I'll direct that to Dr. Newman.
I think it fits in well with the material in Revelation, which pictures that the eternity is not spent in heaven, it's spent on the earth. And you can come down out of heaven, and so to speak, a new heaven and new earth. But the Jerusalem is on earth, and outside of the Jerusalem, you have this individual that you can turn outside, where the worm does not die, etc., which is the same phrase that Jesus used to speak. And then there's that parallel to the Revelation text, which says outside are the things and the liars and all, etc. So, what outside means, as you must know, that Jesus is present those who are thinking for us.
Besides the point of the heaven, they seem to be very explicit about what is going to happen to the heaven. Do they ever mention anything about the earth, about if it's going to be formed, whether it's going to be just before it left. Does it ever address that?
Not in the visionary material. There are some things that talk about earth and changes which will take place on the earth, but I don't remember nothing in visionary material, and I don't remember just offhand anything explicit about its destruction, as you mentioned.
Well,